I'm Allegra Stratton.
And I'm Tom Clark.
And this is Politics Weekly.
On today's show, we'll be asking whether by privatising Royal Mail, the Prime Minister is posting his own suicide note.
We will also look at Tory plans to get into bed with some distinctly odd European right-wingers.
And we'll be swatting up on Gordon Brown's new schools policy.
Joining us to talk about all of this, we've got Mike White down in Westminster. Hello, Mike.
Hello.
Seamus Milne. Hello, Seamus. And Julian Glover.
Hello.
Right, well, this week there's been the return of Royal Mail. There's a whole lot of ideas for it. Labour split with the left wanting to turn it into a not-for-profit trust like Network Rail. Peter Mandelson wants to part privatise it. And the Lib Dems, well, they've come up with a mishmash of both elements with a bit of John Lewis added for good measure. Seamus, come on, who's saying what? Why?
Well, I mean, the Compass proposal, which is the one for the arm's-length Network Rail formula, is a good way of allowing Royal Mail to raise money in the capital markets in the City of London, which, of course, as a nationalised industry, if it does that, it has to, it's counted as part of the government borrowing. And, of course, that's not the time to be doing that. So it's quite a cunning formula. It allows you to raise money, to expand, to have mergers. It allows you to buy in private sector management expertise. So really, I think it's put the ball in the government's court, but the government's already ruled it out. And the question has to be asked, I think, why, since it does look quite suicidal.
And you would prefer that to a John Lewis style?
Well, I think it needs to be a public sector institution. It needs to have the ability to invest and to modernise in the public sector. And this is a way of doing it.
Julian, we've got different ministers pushing different policies on this fairly openly now. Isn't it time for Gordon Brown to decide which side he's on?
He needs to do that. He also needs to decide if he wants to do it. The timing seems to be a particularly controversial thing if it comes in straight after the European elections. Because, of course, this battle is partly about how letters in Britain should be delivered and how the Royal Mail should work and how it should be owned and, as Seamus says, how it should raise money. It's also become, in that Westminster jargon, a test to the Prime Minister's authority. And I think he's now caught between Peter Mandelson, who believes he's got an explicit promise, come what may, the Prime Minister will stick with the Mandelson plan, which can be adjusted at the edges, but is pretty clear, and won't suddenly go off on some new scheme come up from Compass or anyone else, or just do nothing. And then the Labour Party, the Parliamentary Labour Party, probably quite a lot of his cabinet, and the whips, who say, well, this is bonkers, you can't get it through without Tory votes, playing the kind of cat with the mouse of the Tory party, and stuck in the middle is Gordon Brown. And his decision is partly about what to do with postal services, although he could, of course, decide to do nothing. Nothing has been done for many years. He could leave it for the Tories to sort out if they win. He's also got to decide which kind of bit of the Labour Party he wants to back. And if he can get away with not rewarding Peter Mandelson with this, will he have to do something else, make him Foreign Secretary?
Mike, is it possible, as Julian just said, for Gordon to just shelve it? Is that
political? Well, he's shelved it for the last 10 years. If cabinet ministers of the period are to be
PM
believed,
for 10 years.
Just you hang on. Well, he thought he was for most of that time. In 2001, he blocked a sort of reform package, not unlike this one. There's a slight misapprehension here. This isn't Mandelson's package. It's a package based upon a report called the Hooper Report by some regulator who said this is the way out to solve all the problems the colleagues have just been talking about, and the cabinet backed it, and Gordon Brown backed it. They discussed it half a dozen times. It was all in train before Mandelson was brought back from Brussels. So it isn't about Gordon Brown's decision.
But
it's
Mike,
about his decision to be indecisive, to withdraw from what he's already done, because backbenchers tell him they won't do it.
But Mike, well, you can't excuse Mandelson like that. He proposed much the same scheme in the past before one of his multiple resignations. Gordon Brown blocked it then.
Yep.
He came back in. He's stuck his name to it. He's talked about it in public. He's the minister. The Hooper report, well, all governments have convenient reports that justify what they want to do. This is being driven by Peter Mandelson, and if it doesn't happen, he will look weakened.
Well, he's the driving type, Mandelson, which, frankly, in that cabinet, not many of them are. Certainly not Gordon Brown.
Why are we even in this position?
Well,
there
I think
are some reports that are saying last year Royal Mail made £225 million profit.
Well, I think, I mean, it's interesting if John Hutton had stayed on, you know, whether the same thing would have happened. I mean, there were some signals he was giving last autumn that actually he was backing away from this solution. And, I mean, as Julian said, I mean, the Hooper report was designed to give that answer. And, of course, you know, there's different views about you know, what should have happened and whether or not which interests were driving the Hooper report. Because there are big private sector interests which have big influence in the business department, the BER, which, you know, have shaped that report. So I think the real question is why Mandelson stuck his flag on this proposal, which was predictable. It was entirely predictable that it was going to lead to a massive
It was predictable, but you know, everybody's got interest. The fact is, the Post, which was once a profitable setup and used to have negative, what were they called, external financial limits every year,
it
had
to
give the government to the Treasury rather than the model for dud nationalised industries, which took money from the Treasury. But of course, you know, as in our own industry, we're all victims here, partly of sort of market theories, but also of changing technology. Just as the internet has, you know, changed the way newspapers operate, and it's got us as print journalists podcasting because we're adapting to changing
circumstances. That's true, but you have to deal with that whether in the public or private sector, don't you?
Yeah, you can do it either, but I mean, this is partly driven by technology and the relationship. It's not just about the wicked private sector. It's all about the UCW, the Posties Union. We all love the postman. We see him every day.
CW.
And I do. Their role in it, it's not clear to me whether the union leadership is sort of playing both sides of the street, you know, blaming local militancy for blocking deals they've agreed to, or whether it's down to the postman. It's a pretty tough union. They're protecting their turf. It may not, in the long term, be the smart thing to do, and that's why we're in the mess we're in. Something's got to happen, because it's suffering.
When something's got to happen. The question is whether it's in the private sector or not.
Well, that's a detail.
A detail to Labour MPs, and that's the core
that's
of this political
right.
problem.
It's not a detail to Labour MPs, but they're not necessarily the people. You know, you've got the three sides of this one. You've got the management, you've got the unions, and you've got the customers, and as I've said, you've got technology. And when did the last time any of us received a real letter, apart from junk mail, coming through the post? That's the issue.
Well, that's the question, isn't it? I mean, isn't this a strange thing to get worked up about? When did you last send a proper letter, Julian?
Yesterday, to say thank you to somebody for dinner.
That's but that same, was same
oh,
here.
God bless him.
And I have to say that Mike is also
it
in the past
sent
for very nice
Royal
card.
Mail alive. Not thank as, you letters.
You know what I mean, all of you.
Yeah. Well, the looming decision on Royal Mail might reveal the real Gordon Brown. Will Europe do the same for David Cameron? In 2005, he promised to do what no other Tory has done before and sever links with Europe's mainstream right. European Conservatives have always been allied with Sarkozy's Gaullists and Angela Merkel's pro-European Christian Democrats. But while standing for leader, Cameron promised to form a brand new European Parliament bloc. And after next month's election, he finally has to make good on that. I asked The Guardian's Ian Traynor in Brussels exactly who the Conservatives were hoping to join forces with.
They're looking everywhere, really, but it is a motley crew. They're having talks with lots of different parties, from Christian Democrats in Portugal to rather dodgy-looking extreme nationalists in Latvia. The two key committed members of the new grouping, Eurosceptics, are the right-wing party in Poland of the Kaczynski twin brothers, Law and Justice, and in the Czech Republic, the party whose government has just fallen, the Civic Democratic Party, very eurosceptical, right-wing, but libertarian. But it varies. In Belgium, for example, in Flanders, you have a libertarian, small libertarian party known as the Lys Dedeker, who might put up one MEP and would join up with Cameron's new Conservatives. The East Europeans, not so much in the Czech Republic, but the Poles, have a reputation for being reactionary, fairly nationalistic, very anti-German, anti-Russian, homophobic, very pro-Catholic church. A lot of aspects that don't really gel with David Cameron's kind of post-Thatcherite, liberal, compassionate conservatism.
Julian, what is Cameron up to?
Well, it all goes back, as Ian says, to the leadership election when the Conservative Party split over Europe. David Cameron said, I'll be the most Eurosceptic, and he picked up a few votes. He managed to become the party leader. Most people thought that was the end of it. It would go away. He'd fudge the issue of this complex group. I mean, frankly, none of us have probably heard of the EPP or the PES or all these organisations in the European Parliament. It doesn't matter to the public what parties are in. It almost doesn't matter to the individual MEPs. The Tory party in the European Parliament's been split between absolute pro-Europeans and hard anti-Europeans for years. They've got along with this group. Anyway, they've spent ages trying to negotiate this deal. It's hugely embarrassing for Cameron, and it raises to me a more significant question, which is this a serious thing for Cameron that he actually cares about? He really, really doesn't want to be in this EPP. He just wants this new group. Or is he just trying to appease the right? And
what's
it's a wider... Well, I think he cares about it, and it's a wider test, because it's the other, other
why,
party...
Why does he care about it?
Well, that's the question.
And why don't his instincts kick in?
His instincts are anti-European. He doesn't really like the European Union. He's quite sceptical of this sort of federalist, right-wing European politics, just as quite a lot of the Labour Party at times has been sceptical of the Party of European Socialists, which have also been quite federalist and lots of Labour MPs don't like. And I think he feels he has to keep his party on board. But the other part of this is the referendum, because as well as this complex group, which something will come up in the European Parliament after the elections, the Tories claim nice new right-wingers will be elected who will join. Well, we'll see if that happens. Is the promise of a referendum on the treaty. The Czech Republic has just ratified the treaty, so Ireland is now the last state that hasn't ratified it. If Ireland votes yes, it goes through. What will the Tories do when they come to power? William Hague has told the Foreign Office he wants a referendum bill ready within a week of a Tory victory. That's if Ireland has voted no. If Ireland votes yes, what will the Tory party ask for? What will happen? They haven't answered these questions.
Seamus, do we know anything else about these kind of East European groups?
I'm sure Julian's right that the key question is really the referendum issue. However, if I was David Cameron, I would stand in glorious isolation, because the moment he gets into bed with any of these groups, he's going to be in trouble, because the whole of right-wing politics in Eastern Europe is an absolute cesspit. The rise of xenophobia, Roma hatred, attacks on gypsies throughout the eastern part of the continent, anti-Semitism, all sorts of horrors will come up through this process, and the homophobia of the Polish terrible twins. So whoever he goes with, he's going to find himself, you know, the focus of all manner of negative stories about the kind of fellow travellers that the Tories are in with. So, I mean, the obvious answer is to you know, just stand alone.
Mike, what would be the nifty footwork for Cameron now?
I'm puzzled, because I wouldn't disagree with anything any of the colleagues have said. I'm sorry about that. But the one stupid thing that David Cameron has done is paint himself into this particular corner. He can't manage without Europe. He can't manage without the EPP. Julian was slightly wrong when he said these groups don't matter. They do matter, because you have to belong to a group. 19 MEPs from 5 countries are the minimum qualification to become a group. Once you've got one, you qualify for enormous amount of euro boodle, wonga, money. And that's what the BNP, of course, is hoping to do when it wins seats in the European elections on June the 4th, as it almost certainly will do, 3 or 4 perhaps. So it does matter, but it also matters politically, because all these unsavoury hooligans whom we've heard described by Ian Trainey and others, it would be funny if it wasn't serious. But the idea that David Cameron can't manage without Angela Merkel and Nico Sarkozy, they're both Tory politicians the last time I looked, just seems barking, and they won't be able to do it. And the referendum bill, if Hague, who is a very intelligent man indeed, but has gone along with this nonsense, the referendum bill won't deliver anything except an undignified renegotiation of the kind Harold Wilson got in 1975, which was complete fraud and everybody knew it, except they're less tolerant. One last thought. Federalism, come on, the European Union isn't federal, isn't ever going to be federal. How's this great response to the recession been organised? It's been organised or not organised on national lines. And how will regulation of the European banking system be conducted? It'll be conducted on national lines, which is probably why it won't work.
Mike, it's not quite a last thought, because just a really last thought on this. In terms of year before becoming Prime Minister, what was Blair doing? Was there a sort of similar test of Blair in terms of a policy he'd pledged to that he would find difficult to sell?
You're testing my memory now at my age. You mustn't do that without advance notice, Allegra. But my memory was Blair's trick, and quite a successful trick, was to run against his own party. It was unattractive, and the Labour Party resented it, but as an electoral tactic, he picked fights with his own side. Now, Cameron's picked a few, and my theory is that the reason he's given them red meat on Europe is he doesn't care that much. Julian was right to say his gut instinct is against it, which is odd for an expensively educated Etonian with international connections, but there you go. And he's just feeding them. He's also got to fend off UKIP. UKIP is falling down a hole, but that's the default position for Tories, just as the BNP is for Labour people who are hacked off with centrism.
Blair didn't do anything like this, did he, really? He was ruling out rail nationalisation and pension indexing in 1996.
Well, he was positioning himself against his own party. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But Cameron is doing something, therefore, that despite all the talk about modelling himself on Blair, he's doing something completely different here.
Only in this respect.
Appeasing them.
It's more complicated than that, because the big issue is the recession and the economy. And he's trying to, not very successfully in my view, pick a path between rectitude, which the Tories say cut, which is the wrong thing to do at this stage in the recession, although everybody's worried about building up debt, we understand that, you don't do it now. And he's promising at question time yesterday, Tory MPs were attacking Brown on various things, but then asking him for more public expenditure.
Just very quickly, Seamus, OK, he becomes Prime Minister, Cameron becomes Prime Minister. Obama loves Europe. How does this go down with President Obama if we have a Prime Minister Cameron?
Well, I think it'll be a bit tricky. I mean, but I mean, just to pick up Mike's thing. I mean, and what Tom was saying, I don't think that Cameron is doing a Blair at all. I mean, I mean, he started off that way, but I think that the recession and the crisis of last autumn has shifted the centre of gravity in the Tory leadership, despite what George Osborne says in the Guardian today about progressivism, has shifted it in a more right-wing direction, and it's, you know, going to a Tory comfort zone of tax cuts, sorry, of spending cuts right now, as Mike says, which is entirely the wrong
thing.
They've
lost three elections going into their comfort zone.
I would disagree. Yeah, exactly. I would disagree with that. It isn't a comfort zone at all. It's an incredibly difficult thing to propose going into government, the idea of cuts. The comfort zone is just to say, we'll do what the last government did, but be a bit better at it, which is what the Tory party used to be saying. They're getting harder and tougher, and it's not comfortable for them at all. They're saying this because they think they need to do it.
Well, with the Conservatives calling yet again for a general election and attacking the Prime Minister for appalling judgment, etc., perhaps the only salvation now for Gordon Brown is to concentrate on policy. This week, the Prime Minister attempted to refocus attention on education. The Guardian's Polly Curtis outlines his plans.
So Gordon Brown announced these plans to give parents more power and say over the range of schools in their area. This would be through some sort of survey which would assess parents' opinions, and then if too many were unhappy, that would force the local authority to act. But what was quite interesting about it was this idea, a shift away from central control of schools, and they talked about getting rid of some of the targets, getting rid of kind of the overly central system at the moment, and replacing it with local accountability. So instead of government directing schools, there would be a stronger sense of local communities directing schools. Now, you'd think that's what local democracy was about and why we have local government and local elections, but perhaps these surveys are a new way for that to work. The other strong point he made was an attack on, you know, the Tory suggestions that public spending would have to decrease. And he said downturn is no time to slow down our investment in education. And, you know, he's very strongly saying that we need the skills to kind of build our way out of the recession, and in that making a dig at the Tories. In reality, who knows who's going to have the money to do anything in education.
Seamus, I've heard tell that you loved the speech.
No, that's putting it too strongly. But I mean, I do think that it's right that the government should try and separate itself more on mainstream domestic policy issues from the Tories. It's difficult for Brown to do that and for the government to do that because, of course, in education it's been following a softer version of what Michael Gove wants to do now for a number of years. But the ship is turning around rather slowly. And so the problem is, I think it looks quite indistinct, and it doesn't get the message across of a distinct and clear new policy direction. But I think it is heading in a positive direction. I mean, in the sense that, you know, anyone who's had their kids through schools, as I have in recent years, knows that, you know, the system of governance in schools is very, very weak indeed. It's extremely hard to change the direction of a school because there are all sorts of entrenched interests in the you know, governing bodies, and it's very hard to get change. And it just simply doesn't happen through local elections and local authorities. So something that holds that system to account to parents or citizens in an area, I think, is a positive direction. But it's very indistinct, and I think as a sort of political positioning, it's too weak at the moment. But I think the direction is right.
Mike, can you see now a clear difference between Labour education policy and Tory education policy?
Well, it's always muddled, as everybody says, but you could say that almost certainly that Tory education policy will marketise choice and allow people with sharp elbows and articulate people. They're not all middle class by any means, but we all know people who've come from very bad backgrounds who've fought their way up through the system with tough parents. By and large, it's the sharp-elbowed and articulate people who get more than their share of the welfare state, including education, and it's hard to change. Labour, in different ways, not successfully in many respects, has tried to give the poor a better share of the goodies, and that's what Blair's attempt at academies was a mixed success, but that's what was trying. Michael Gove will marketize it and allow for the creation of free schools and other things. I'd say it was a fairly clear but muddled division.
Yes, it was clear but muddled.
But muddled, that's good.
It was clear but muddled. That's, in many ways, that is the character of Gordon Brown. Two quick things. One is why on earth is Gordon Brown doing his policy speeches now? He should have done it before he became Prime Minister. He should have done it in the first year and a bit. It's far too late now. We're discussing proposals. It will never happen.
And he shouldn't have done it in direct competition with Lumley on the television. Was it a hard choice where the TV cameras went, was it?
That wasn't in the grid, and a successful Prime Minister would still dominate. He's now going to do this series of speeches. Education was the first that we're going to get others. Apparently this fabled Law and Order speech will finally come from the Prime Minister who never talks about the subject. He should have done it ages. It's almost too late now. We don't really find much of what he says interesting. The next election, you know, what's he going to be putting forward? It's too late to be setting out proposals for 2011 now. But the harder thing is on education. He's got to decide whether he really believes that schools should be pretty much self-run or whether they shouldn't. Tony Blair, by the end, was very clear on that. Gordon Brown is not. And so he ended up caricaturising both sides. He said free market madness or absolute local control. I want to find a way between those two things. He didn't explain what that route is. Everybody agrees that there's a route somewhere in the middle of those two things. He's got to be more specific about the details.
Seamus, I mean, I know Blairites who thought the speech was really good, and they actually think that Ed Balls is actually sacrilegious to say, but actually done some quite good things. What would you say of Balls the economist trying to be Balls the educationalist?
Well, I think that it is moving in a better direction, and I don't agree with Julian that you know it's too late for this government to do anything. I mean, obviously it's expected to lose the election for, you know, as any incumbent government in this crisis will be expected to do, and because of the you know negative experiences and the reputation of Gordon Brown. However, I mean, you know, whether it loses or it doesn't, it's important to set out a new policy agenda for the future and for the government and the Labour Party to shift in response to what's happened in the real economy in the real world. So my problem with it is that I don't think it's clear enough, and I don't think the change is you know sharp enough. But it does seem to me it's shifting in a better direction on this and other policies.
I thought the best line in the speech really was where he said most parents don't really want to run schools, because we had from Tony Blair and now from Michael Gove, the Tory education spokesman, this idea that loads of groups of parents will be coming together, setting up schools and then running them. Some might in Dulwich or wherever, but this isn't going to happen up and down the country, is it?
It's just a mythology. I mean, the so-called independent schools within the state sector are run by parents. It just doesn't happen.
And that perhaps ties to some of the core of what Gordon Brown's thinking is, and perhaps what he should have explained more clearly, because he gave a speech a few years ago on the health service in which he said most people don't want choice, they want good hospitals. And he was very strong, and it was a good message, and lots of people would agree with that. He then... And the government's policy didn't follow that through. And on education, he seems to be coming back to that. Individuals don't always want to decide things for themselves, don't want to run things. What they want is some quality, and they want effective and clear routes to complain if things don't work.
They do want accountability.
They want accountability.
Yeah.
And that's
a
really
choice,
good...
choice, actually, you know. And well, choice is also, it isn't simply a consumer option. It's about competition driving up standards, and there is some evidence to support that. Blair oversold it.
Well, I wouldn't go the other way either.
It seems to me the big... problem, which has never resolved in the last 20, 30 years, way back even before Thatcher, is if you want national standards and everybody to have and local control, people pay lip service to local control, but as soon as Blankshire doesn't do as well as Leicestershire or Staffordshire, everybody says, hey, we want the same as them.
I thought you couldn't go that far back without advance notice, Mike.
Well, I don't do the detail back that far, but I do remember who she was, which is more than she does.
Well, that's it for this week. Thanks to Julian Glover, Seamus Milne, and down the line, Michael White.
Next week we've got Madeline Bunting and Jackie Ashley, who'll be here with Tom and I. Till then,
goodbye.